This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all Have Another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, HRRN Nation, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again, extending a special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM Channel 206, and to everyone tuning in on our website, on your smartphone, or on your tablet with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. Welcome to the show and happy to have you with us here as we get set for another exciting version of Trainer Talk. And we do it with trainer Neil Pessin tonight. He doesn't have the big numbers of a Pletcher, an Asmussen, or a Mott. He doesn't typically send out three or four horses on the same card, but he is one of the most well-liked and respected trainers in the game today, and there would be very few people that would argue that one with you. And Neil is with us here on the program tonight. Thanks, buddy.
Well, thank you. I might argue that, but that's okay.
Well, come on. You're too humble. You have a great sense of humor, too, by the way.
Well, sometimes I do. We like to play little jokes, you know, keeps things lively on the backside.
What's the best joke you've played?
Oh, now there was a few things that we've done in the past. You know, Bobby Barnett and Dr. Reed used to have an ongoing little feud. And, like, Bobby got a goose down jacket one year for Christmas, and Dr. Reed kind of borrowed it. And Bobby was looking all over for it, and so Dr. Reed showed back up with it on the racetrack. He was wearing the vest, and another trainer, Tommy Morgan, was wearing the sleeves. And Bobby goes galloping by on the pony and stops and turns around and looks at him and turned around and started hollering at him, and Ken and Tommy took off running, and feathers were flying everywhere.
Come on.
So one of the retaliations we did is Dr. Reed goes yachting or boating in the wintertime a lot. So he had a picture of him. He had on a Speedo.
A Speedo.
Dr. Reed's pretty much bald.
You really know how to paint the picture on radio. You know that, right?
Yes, of course. Dr. Reed's kind of bald, but he's wearing a wig with a ponytail. He had a big loop earring in and holding a spear. And his wife took a picture of that. Well, somehow I got the picture. And I had access to a printing press at the newspaper down in New Orleans. So we had blown up just a little bigger than life size and mounted on some plywood. So we waited to the end of the meet because we knew Dr. Reed could retaliate also. So we put it up in Louis Roussel has a barn there and has an apartment attached to it with a glass door facing the racetrack. So we put it up in the glass door facing the racetrack, and we called Dr. Reed up to the apartment. And he came, and I just happened to have a couple of photographers around, too.
Sure.
Skip Dickstein and Alex Barkoff were there. And so Dr. Reed goes up, and he looks up and sees his picture in the door and kind of dropped to one knee and didn't know really what to say. And everybody comes out and starts taking his picture and all that stuff. So he goes up and gets the mounted picture and just walks around with it because he really can't say a whole lot.
Has anybody ever come back on you with a good one?
Well, Dr. Reed thought he was getting even. He just flattened the air in my golf cart tires.
Okay.
But I warned him. I said, I know you're going to get even. I understand that. I said, but just remember, I have access to the printer and I can make up any size copies I want, as many as I want, and distribute them all over.
That's one thing that has always struck me about you, and you're always very fun-loving. You keep it light around the barns and you keep it light around the racetrack. That's kind of your style, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think you have to, because if you take it, you've got to take it serious as far as taking care of the horses and training the horses and that kind of thing. But if you take it serious with you to out of here and you take it home with you and everything eats on you. I used to do that, but I've learned that you're better off if you are a little lighter about it, if you can kid about it, you know, whatever happens, happens. You only worry about the things that are in your control.
Is it difficult to leave everything at the racetrack when you leave for the day?
Yeah, sometimes it is. Not necessarily, you know, especially if you've got a really nice horse, you know, and there's a small issue where you might miss a grade one race. You know, that eats at you for 3 or 4 days.
Sure.
You know, especially if you're a small stable, because you don't get a chance at that very often. So, you know, if you're the Todd Pletchers, like you were mentioning, you know, they've got another grade one maybe that day.
Right.
Or tomorrow. Whereas a small trainer might have a grade one shot once every 5 years. So if something happens, you know, then you got to, you know, it weighs on you. But like I say, you've got to learn to only worry about the things you can control.
Of course, you are in business for yourself. Trainers are self-employed, which means, and I know the feeling, which means that the phone never stops. And it could ring at 8 o'clock at night, could ring at 9 o'clock at night. And that has to make it difficult to try to separate the home life from the racetrack life as well.
Well, the only calls I get late at night that I'll take anymore are from the barn.
Okay.
Because that means there's a problem and I need to get
out there.
That's
not a call you want to get.
It's not a call I want to get. But that's why the phone always stays on.
Yeah.
And just in case there's a call from the barn. Any other calls that come after 9 o'clock, I don't answer.
Yep. Yeah.
So, and everybody knows that.
I've had trainers tell me the worst words you can hear are, "Boss, you need to come take a look at this."
Yes. Did you see?
I can remember, Neil, going back to when my predecessor was getting me started on the radio back in 2003, Pete Kulis. He would host a show at Keeneland, and he would do it from the racing office every morning. And you were a regular guest every meet. It was a different type of show. It was an educational program. And you would come on, and you would talk about the different types of equipment that trainers would use on their horses and let people know why trainers make those decisions and what those pieces of equipment are for. And that educational aspect of the game is something you have always been really big on.
Yeah, well, I think even people coming up in the game need to know the basics. You know, like I used to give the training test down in Louisiana when they had a barn test for trainers. And I think I passed one person out of maybe 20.
Sure.
Because they either couldn't put a saddle on. One guy told me, he says, "Why don't we get someone else to saddle for me?"
No kidding.
I said, "No. Not under my watch anyway." But I think it's very important that people learn from the bottom up. And a lot of people don't anymore. Even trainers, you'll see trainers coming from different areas of life and just jump into training. They don't do any background work. You know, all your top trainers had a lot of education coming up. They worked under a lot of people. They put years in as assistants, and they came up slow. Now you got people wanting to jump in and do it right away. And they don't know little idiosyncrasies of horses, never mind handling the owners and the people and your help. But they don't know what to look for, even with the horse, how he comes out of the race. I was just talking to my racing manager today about how a horse came out of the race, and a lot of people don't know that.
Sure.
And they rely on other, you know, another thing that a lot of people forget is shoeing horses, the blacksmith. There's probably very few trainers can tell you whether a horse is shod level or not, or even what that means. So, but that's a part of education.
Well, you never had that problem because you were kind of born into it. Your dad was a veterinarian, so you were around the game from the very beginning. Take me back to those early days.
Well, early days, we had a farm called Winchester Farm, which was a breeding farm. We had 500 acres, and we had our best stallion was Olden Times, who I'm sure you probably know.
Sure.
We also had Candy Spots, Prove It, and you know, we probably had about 12 stallions. But Olden Times was the star of the stallion that we had.
Yeah.
And I was working the farm when I was 3 years old and setting feed and leading horses in and out. And I remember one time I memorized every stallion that we had, like the names and who they were buying out of, how much money they'd made. I knew everything when I was like 4 years old.
Yeah.
So I'm given a tour of the stallions with my sister, who was a year younger than me. And the names were on the door. You know, they had the frame with the name on the door and the breeding.
Sure.
Now I couldn't read it, but I knew what it was. So, but my sister thought I was reading it, and she got pissed off. She said, "God damn, Neil, I didn't know you knew how to spell or how to read."
Yeah.
So it made her learn how to read faster.
I can imagine that would be a bit frustrating for her.
Yeah, it was. So then after Winchester Farm, we bought the training center out on Paris Pike, which Kingland now owns. And we were the original builders of that. And we had a breeding farm and a training center. It was 50-50.
Yep.
And we just had the 5/8 of a mile covered racetrack and the 200-300 stall barns. And then we had some barns up on the hill behind it. And then the breeding farm was behind that.
Okay.
So that's where I started learning to train. We had about 80 horses in training ourselves. And when I was like 13 years old, our farm manager trainer went on vacation for a month. And I kind of took over running it.
Wow.
So, which was fine until I fired three people.
And oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Well, they needed to be fired. They were kind of lazy. And I went up and told Dad. I said, very proud. I said, I fired three today. He said, you did? I said, yeah. He said, who you got to replace them? I said, well, I'll find someone. He said, well, until you do their work. So I learned a very valuable lesson.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's quite the lesson.
Don't fire anybody until you have a replacement for them.
Have somebody else in mind anyway.
Yeah, have them coming that day.
Yeah. Wow, that's an amazing story. And when you think back on being around it from the age of three, as you mentioned, working around the farm and the stallions and being in that type of environment, did you ever at any point consider doing anything other than horse racing?
Yeah, I was, well, not horse racing, but I was thinking about being a veterinarian.
Okay.
Didn't know if it was going to be racetrack or farm.
Following your dad's footsteps.
Following Dad's footsteps. Dad was both.
Okay.
He was considered at his time the best diagnostician in Lexington
mm-hmm.
for mares or for racehorses. And I didn't know which one I wanted to do, so I did all the pre-vet classes.
Okay.
And then I worked on the racetrack one summer and really liked it. Just grooming. Why I liked it, I have no clue, but I did.
Which racetrack?
Started at Churchill, actually. Okay. But I worked Saratoga, Belmont, Churchill, Kingland. Worked for Ronnie Warren quite a bit.
Okay.
Who a lot of people think was nuts, and he partially was, but he was a great horseman. One of the best caretakers I've ever seen.
Wow.
And a real good horseman. And I think we won 6 stakes in 6 weeks one time, and this is when there weren't, 14 stakes every weekend. You know, each track had one stake on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And we won 6 stakes in 6 weeks with the best bred horse, probably just on pedigree, wasn't worth $10,000. So, and he had some nice horses, Betty Money, Fact Finder, Promising Native, Withholding, all while I was there, Rock Steady.
What's the biggest lesson that he taught you? Or the biggest thing you took away from working with him that maybe you still use today?
Care of the horse.
Yeah.
The care of the horse. And he was very big on that, the feed and the care.
How about your dad? What did he teach you?
Dad taught me a lot. Dad taught me, one, when I first started training, that I would pamper the horses a lot. I mean, training-wise, too. I wouldn't put a lot of pressure on them. When they run, they'd come up short.
Mm-hmm.
Dad taught me you have to get them fit. If they can't train, they can't run. Because you don't want to run. A lot of people will take horses that aren't real sound sometimes and try and make a race with them. If I've got a horse in, you can bet he's going to make the race. I mean, something can always happen to a totally sound horse. But if I've got one in, there's not a major problem that we're aware of. So one, the main thing he taught me was they got to be fit to run. And the other thing he taught me on the other side of that is they don't have to be overfit. A lot of people overtrain. And there's a happy median, and you got to know each horse is different. You can't train them all the same.
So there is a fine line.
There is a fine line.
Yeah.
To get a horse up to a race in the right way.
Visiting with trainer Neil Pessin on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. How do you know when you're coming up to that line and you're just where you need to be in that, I'll call it that zone, and the horse is fit but not overfit?
Well, it's all in how they train, how when you breeze them, how they come back, how quick they recover from it, if they have to recover at all. You know, if they come off the track and they're not even blowing, you know you're in a good spot. If they come off bouncing, you know, if they're happy for them, you know, if they're not back in the corner of the stall sulking.
Mm-hmm. So it's the language of the horse.
Yes.
That's how they can talk to you?
Oh, yeah.
Through their movements. I've heard several trainers tell me that they can sense from just watching the horse move how they're doing and where they are in comparison to their fitness levels, where they need to be.
Right, and how they eat. A lot of it's, you need a horse to eat well. because that's where they get all their proteins and vitamins and energy.
Mm-hmm.
Comes from the food. So if you have a horse that's not eating well, that's a problem. And you have to figure out a way to get them to start eating.
Yeah. You credit your dad for so much of what you've learned over the years, and I think rightfully so. Outside of that fitness angle and training them the right way, what other things?
Well, also going back to the care of the horse. And believe it or not, he was a veterinarian, and I probably use less meds than most veterinarians or most trainers do.
By design.
By design.
Yeah.
Because my dad taught me most of the stuff you need to do should be oral. You know, like even the vitamin jugs I do orally in mm-hmm. the feed instead of jugging them in the vein. And just watch the horse and take care of the horse, and you won't have to do all the extra medication. My biggest vet bills are if a horse gets sick, and we got to treat him every day with antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. And that's a shift in philosophy that we've seen in the sport in recent years from the old days where we were always told it was hay, oats, and water, and now we hear all the medication debates, and it's a completely different game now than it was back then, isn't it?
It is, but, I mean, even back in the hay, oats, and water day, there was other things.
Yeah.
You know, like butazolidin was big back then when it wasn't supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we can use that 24 hours out. At one time, we could use it the morning of. So, but the game's changed a lot with, you know, people having their own pharmacies and trying to cheat. And, you know, the game's more worried about Lasix when, to me, that's a non-issue. If you can stop a horse from bleeding, why don't you use it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, they're worried about bute, Banamine, Lasix. Well, they ought to be worried about stuff that people are using they can't test for.
Yeah.
The real cheaters in the game.
I've always said that the Lasix debate, not to get into that on this program, it's really not what it's about, but I've always said that Lasix was, you know, simply used as posturing by the industry to make it look like they were doing something to clean up the sport, but that was never really the true evil.
Right. I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah. Yeah, Neil Pessin on Trainer Talk. Neil, you mentioned training for more than 30 years now, and that relationship.
I started when I was six.
When you were six.
Yeah.
Training horses.
Training horses.
And with your dad.
Well, no. I started when I was six, if it was 30 years ago, because I'm not that old.
Oh, right. Yeah. There's that wit. See, the rip we talked about in the beginning. I have to keep up a little bit. I got to be on my P's and Q's when we're talking here. But how about your mom? Was your mom encouraging about you getting involved in the sport?
Mom was for whatever I wanted to do. She really wanted me to be a lawyer or a doctor.
Of course.
Right. Like all good Jewish mothers, you know. Got to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
But, and I was, my grades were good enough I could have done whatever I wanted to do. I mean, I was on the dean's list and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Pinecrest Preparatory, 10th, 11th, and 12th as a prep school in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
I was here in Lexington for 1st through 9th, and 10th, 11th, 12th at Pinecrest, and I went 2 years to Center and 2 years to UK.
Okay.
Because Center didn't really have a pre-veterinarian program.
Mm-hmm.
So I was transferred to UK to take the pre-vet.
And even when you were in school, you were still focused on the horse side of things. That's all you ever wanted to do.
Well, let's just say I did make Churchill a couple times during college.
You never gave any serious thought to becoming a lawyer?
No. No, much to my mom's chagrin, I did not.
Which of your parents is responsible for that wit and that sense of humor?
I'd say both are. Both, because, you know, to live with each other, they had to have a pretty good sense of humor.
Okay.
Dad was pretty tough, so.
Was he tough? Was he tough on you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
There was no getting out of line with Dad. He'd put you right back in quick.
So why was it training? Why did you decide on training as opposed to some other aspect of the sport?
Well, I think when we had the training center, we had the horses in training and got to go to the races. I really liked the racing part of it. If I'd known what all was involved getting to the races, it may have been a different story. But but it's just something I like doing. And, you know, I don't mind the traveling that much. I love going to New Orleans in the wintertime.
Yeah. So what's your favorite part of being a horse trainer?
Winning. Still, especially occasionally if you beat somebody that you've kind of been having a little battle with, you know?
Yeah.
Or little wits.
Do trainers have rivals like we see in other sports with athletes?
They're going to tell you absolutely not, but that's not true. every trainer has a couple of guys that they would just love to beat. And if they tell you any different, they're lying.
Who does Neil Pessin like beating best?
Everybody.
Good answer. Hey, have you, when you first started and you're kind of getting your operation off the ground, and you get in the starting gate with some of the big name trainers of the sport. What's that moment like?
That doesn't really bother me. I care more about my horse than who I'm in with.
Mm-hmm.
And if I got my horse in the right spot, I don't care who's in there. If I've got the horse, I don't care who's in the race. But I never let big names bother me or anything like that.
But it's nice when you beat them.
It's always nice. It's nice when you win.
Yeah.
It's nicer to beat. I'd rather beat the big guys than the little guys, because I'm rooting for the little guys too. You know, you always like to see the little guys do well, because in honesty, they're the ones that make the sport. It's not the big guys. The big guys help the big races, but the little guys are there for the everyday races that fill the card and make the races go.
Yeah. Yeah.
So without them, we couldn't do it.
And I've said that about the breeding side of things as well. Very much the same
Absolutely.
Same thing on the breeding side. We see the Darleys and the Spendthrifts and the Gainsways of the world, which are gorgeous, and they mean so much to the sport. But it's those small mom-and-pop operations that really help drive the business.
Oh, absolutely. You got to have the guys that breed, you know, 10 horses or less,
mm-hmm.
because they're the ones that are the backbone. And it's the same with owners. You've got to have the big owners, but if you don't have the little owners, there's no races for the big owners to run in.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Neil Pessin here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So when you look back over these past 30 years, going back to when you were six
Thank you.
And starting to train, and you start looking back at your career, what are some of the days or the moments that really stand out to you?
Boy, that's tough. I've had a few. Winning the Transylvania Stakes here at Kingland and paying $130 was pretty nice. Because I really liked the horse, and I told everybody to bet on him.
Yeah. Chin high?
Chin high, yep. Coaxing Matt, winning a couple races here, a couple stakes. I don't know. Joey Jr., I claimed for $5,000, won a stake.
Okay.
Sharp Singer, I claimed for $5,000, won a stake. Now, just for your owners out there, that's not a regular thing, just so you know.
Is that maybe even a little more special when you do find a horse in the claiming ranks, and then you turn him into a stakes caliber type of runner? Is that more rewarding, doing it that way?
It can be. I mean, it just depends. You know, it's each race is different on how you approach it. And, you know, the graded stakes are still more rewarding than I found. Ronnie Warren told me a long time ago, he says, the only races that really matter are the stake races. And I didn't believe him at the time.
Yeah.
I thought, you're full of crap. A 5,000 claiming race is great if you can win it. And I still feel that way, but he's right. The races that really matter are the stake races. That's what drives the business. If it wasn't for the stake races, nobody would be in the game.
Sure.
There's a few people in it to win any race, but they're all looking to try and win the stake races.
Yeah.
They're all looking to get to the Derby.
What's the most horses you've saddled in one day?
Four.
What was that day like?
Busy. It was good. I had one filly that was 4-5 to win a stake. She ran last. I had another horse in a stake that won. I had another horse in allowance race that won, and another horse in a stake that ran third. So it was a pretty good day overall.
It's a great day.
The one that was supposed to win, though, that was 4-5, ran dead last.
It's a head scratcher when that happens, isn't it?
Yeah. Sometimes you don't figure it out. You just throw it in. You say, yeah, it was a filly.
Yeah.
She had a bad day.
Will you actually go back and watch the replays of those races afterwards and try to figure out what might have gone wrong with a horse like that?
On something like that, you watch it once, but that's about all you can stand to watch it.
Yeah.
Because there's really, when you see there's no excuse in the race, there's no need to go back and drill it into your head that you run last with the 4-5 shot. You kind of want to put that behind you and move on to the next one.
Right.
You look for something at the barn. Something to pop up or show up or any kind of infirmity that you might find. In this case, we didn't have one that day.
We will hear jockeys talk about having a short-term memory, and they come out and they get beat in the first race or the second race, and they know that they gave the horse a bad ride, and it was their fault that they lost. But they have to go back out 30 minutes later and ride another race, and they have to get that out of their head. Sounds like it's the same thing for trainers.
Yeah, but it's harder for trainers, because especially for someone like me, you know, where you may not run one for 2, 3, 4, 5 days or a week, you know, so you dwell on that for a little longer than you really should. I've learned to try and put that behind me now. You know, as you get older, you get a little wiser.
Yeah.
And you learn that that's stuff you need to put behind you.
Is there more pressure then on you as a smaller trainer when you're not running every single day and running 6-7 horses a day, and you know that your chances to win these races are limited? Is there more pressure when you actually send one to the post?
Well, you put more pressure on yourself, and it depends on your owners too. If your owners are okay, then that's fine. You know, if they, sometimes an owner will put pressure on you. The worst thing that happened to a trainer was the computer, because the condition book is now on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have owners calling you and saying, when the, as soon as the book comes out, I haven't even seen the book yet. Well, there's a race for so-and-so on the 14th. Okay. That's nice. Why don't we see how we're doing up to that point?
Right.
You know, we like, I like to get the condition book and plan races out, but the owner's already there ahead of you sometimes. And sometimes not always in the best interest of the horse, because they'll feel like the horse can run because it's been 2 weeks.
Yep.
Well, some horses can run back that quick, and some need 6 weeks. Just depends on, each horse is different on what they need to do and how long you need to give them between races.
How about percentages, winning percentages? Now that they're published everywhere, seems like so many owners want to go with the big-name trainers that have those high win percentages. Has that changed the game?
That's changed a lot, and it's also caused a lot of races to have a lot of scratches. Because trainers will enter horses, and they get the sheets now, or they look at the rags, or they handicap the race, and they say, well, I don't think I can win this race, so they scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't worry about percentages, because I'm looking more to develop horses. And you've got some horses that are going to take 2, 3, 4 races before they figure out what the game's about. And you just got to develop them and bring them along slowly. And, but there's a lot of trainers that won't run a horse if he doesn't think he can win. Or if they'll take a horse, if they have a big stable and their percentage is dropping down below, say, 18 or 20%, they'll take some horses that are worth $25,000 and run them for $15,000 to $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
So they can win and get their percentages back up. Whereas the little guys really can't do that. If they got a horse worth $25,000, they have to run him for $25,000 because they can't afford the empty stall.
Right.
The big guys had empty stall, they got another horse in it. The little guys got an empty stall, it stays empty.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a whole different mentality,
right,
for trainers that don't have the big numbers.
Right, and I don't worry about percentages, you know. But I'm kind of the old bull on his way out, you know, kind of deal. If you're the young bull on your way in, you got to worry about that, because people will look at your percentages and correlate that to you being a good trainer or a bad trainer. There are some great trainers out there that have a 6-8% win ratio. But they don't get the horses, but they got to run them in certain spots where they lucky if they, you know, run second or third, never mind win. But they're good horsemen.
Yeah. Visiting with trainer Neil Pessin on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. We're going to get to a break. We'll come back with more. We'll talk about some of his greatest stakes wins that he's had over the years. We talked about Chin High. We're going to tell you that story coming up in the second half of the program. Stay with us. It's Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton.
Celebrating 10 years of Eclipse award-winning coverage. Thank you for making HRRN your home for a decade of memories.
The Fasic Tipton Yearling Sales, your roadmap to success. In 2014, the Fasic Tipton Saratoga Sale, July Sale, and New York Bred Sale were ranked the top three sales in North America by rate of return. And the July Sale was once again a top-ranked sale by percentage of graded stakes-winning graduates, with an average of more than $94,000, including undefeated leading Kentucky Derby contender, Dortmund.
Dortmund is all heart. He shifted his ground a little, but he's clear. And Dortmund, another stylish performance. Dortmund wins.
The Fasic Tipton Saratoga Sale is annually the number one ranked North American yearling sale by percentage of Grade 1 winners. In 2014, the Saratoga Sale boasted a $291,000 average and a median of more than $237,000, with past graduates including Grade 1 Don Handicap winner Constitution and the brilliant juvenile champion American Pharoah.
American Pharoah will romp home in the Rebel.
It's never too late to nominate, so make plans now to sell your yearlings at the leading sales in North America. Visit fasictipton.com to nominate today.
And they're off to New York. the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
Jude Feld, the pontiff of the Pick Four. You hear him on HRRN Radio. Now get his personal selections directly from him at his new site, PopeJude.com. Every analysis sheet at PopeJude.com has his personal selections and insights. Each page is a handicapping lesson packed with years of racing knowledge, coupled with insider information gleaned from the pontiff's countless connections in thoroughbred racing. Whether you're looking for another set of eyes on the past performances or inspired racing analysis to assault the windows, PopeJude.com is the site for you.
Celebrating 10 years of Eclipse award-winning coverage.
And it is a true privilege to be joined by legendary golfer and Hall of Famer Gary Player.
They say Frankel is the best horse. The British say that. They talk rubbish. Frankel is the best grass horse, maybe ever. Its secretary would have kicked his butt on dirt. So let's be reasonable. Say he was the best grass horse. Don't say he's the best, period. It's very deceiving and very incorrect.
Thank you for making HRRN your home for a decade of memories. The history.
Coming to the wire, Seattle Slough opens it to four lanes.
The majesty.
Big Brown bounding home to a convincing end in the Run for the Roses.
The excitement.
Mindless Bird has won the Kentucky Derby. An impossible result here.
The most exciting 2 minutes in sports. The Kentucky Derby, next Saturday, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern. Exclusively on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, this is Doug O'Neill. My favorite radio show is the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, continuing my visit with trainer Neil Pessin, and it's been an enjoyable first half of the program. If you did miss any portion of the show, don't forget, you can go to our website, horseracingradio.net, a podcast of this program and all of our Trainer Talk shows available for you at horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Neil, we touched on Chin High in the first half of the program, and you talked about winning the Transylvania Stakes with him here at Keeneland and the big price, and it's an amazing story. We're going to get to Chin High in a minute. That was in 2006, but I want to start with your first graded stakes winner, which came in 1993, and that was a pretty good year for you. You won two graded stakes that year, the first, the Keeneland Breeders' Cup Stakes, which was a grade three, and then you came back and took the Elkhorn, which was with the same horse, Coaxing Matt.
Right.
Tell me about those days.
Coaxing Matt was a fun horse to be around. He was tough to train, but he was a cribber and he was a weaver. and we stopped him from the cribbing part most of the time, but the weaving we couldn't stop. And I didn't really try because he was running so well. So sometimes I'd even get in the stall and weave with him. He'd get on the he'd face the side wall and just weave back and forth. So I'd go in and I'd say, we're going to dance together. So we'd go in and dance together for about 5 minutes. So I got really tired. He just kept going. And but he was fun to be around. I mean, he won a stake at fairgrounds before we came up here. Then we ran in the race here, and he won. We ran the race at the fairgrounds, and he had a foot issue after the race where most of his wall just disintegrated.
Oh, wow.
We don't know what caused it or why. It just disintegrated. He had no wall left at all, but he wasn't sore on it. So he didn't get all the way down to the laminae. But all the wall was coming off in chunks. So I got him back up here, and this is when glue-ons were just starting to come around.
Were you thinking he was done at that point?
No, because he wasn't sore.
Okay.
He wasn't sore. And if he'd been any kind of lame or sore on it, then I know it wouldn't have been done, but it had been time. So we get back up here, and we put the glue-ons on. Everything's great. We run him in the stake here, and he wins. And then we're going to the stake at Churchill. So we look at the shoes, and I'm asking the blacksmith, I said, do you think we ought to reshoe him or leave him as is? So we looked at the shoes. You know, he didn't have a lot of foot growth yet. The shoes were good and tight. No problem. So we run in the stake at Churchill. I think we ran fifth, and he came back with one shoe missing. And the next morning, he walks, makes one turn around the barn, and he walks by my tack room. And when he walked by the tack room, he threw his right front out, and the other shoe rolled up and stood right by my feet.
Oh, come on.
The glue had come undone. It wasn't the shoes that came off. The whole Equilox that we'd put on there to put the shoe on had come off. So, and that's what happened in the race with the other shoe, too.
Well, what a horse to be able to overcome all of that and still continue to run at a very high level and win these graded stakes. When you won that Keeneland Breeders' Cup Stakes, after spending all those years learning and paying your dues and to see it come to fruition with a graded stakes win, that day had to be very special.
It was, and you get a lot of phone calls, which is great. Text messages, and I mean, all you can do is text back, K, thanks, and
right.
It might take you 2 hours to do
now,
it.
That was 93. Were you getting text messages in 93?
I believe I was. Or maybe it was Chin High. Maybe it's Chin High's getting text messages.
Yeah, 2006, I'm sure.
But I was fighting the cell phones. So, but a lot of messages. We used to have the answering machine at the barn.
Yeah.
So I remember when they used to come lock the phones up.
Oh, that's right. They would.
I'm actually
the
one
because
that,
you couldn't call your bookie, right? Wasn't that what
you
it
could,
was?
Well, you couldn't call anybody. They didn't want you calling the bookies, but they didn't want you calling anyone giving out results. So I remember when the cell phones first came on and Keeneland was still locking the phones up. And I went to Mr. Greeley, was president at the time. I said, Mr. Greeley, I said, there's guys in the grandstand on cell phones. I said, you really think we still need to lock the phones up at the barn?
Wow.
And the next season, they didn't lock them up.
Yeah. So then comes Chin High in 2006. Let's talk about him for a minute and that Transylvania Stakes. You mentioned the big price, what, $130-some,
I think he paid.
Yeah. Yeah, and you loved him.
I loved him.
Loved him that day.
A dollar across got you back a little over 100.
Wow. How did you feel so confident with a horse like that?
Just because he was training really well and doing really well, and he was coming into the – he broke his maiden at Evangeline Downs, his last start. But – and everyone always had a – you know, thinking Evangeline was cheap and not having good horses. But that particular year was the year of Katrina down in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So the New Orleans meet was at Louisiana Downs. And after and they ran an abbreviated meet. So after Louisiana Downs was over, everybody just stayed there. And at Evangeline was all the same horses that would have been in New Orleans.
Okay.
So I won the race. I think either Larry Robidoux or Al Stahl were second and third. You know, so it was a tough race. It was a tough maiden race.
Yeah.
And he won pretty handily. And I knew he'd be better on turf than dirt. So we came up here and he just trained really well. And I worked him on the turf and he worked great. And because I had him entered in the turf and also had him entered an allowance race the next day.
Okay.
And the other end. So in case the turf was going to be, I didn't want to run him if it was going to be a real soft turf.
Yeah.
So I ended up running in the stake and I went in to scratch him the next day out of the A other than. And they said, well, what's your reason? I said, well, he's not eligible anymore. He won the stake yesterday. I said, oh, okay, you're out.
How great is it to be able to say those words, though?
The won the stake was, it's always great. I don't care. I don't care who you are, how big you are. Winning the stake is special.
Yeah.
Because it's not easy to do.
Well, especially doing it at Keeneland.
At Keeneland.
Being a native of Lexington, that had to just add to the excitement of the day.
Yeah, if I had to pick one place to win a stake, it's here.
Yeah. So, but you'll take them anywhere.
I'll take them at Poho Junction. I don't care where it is. No, but it's special to win a race at Keeneland because, you know, you got family and friends here. And also, even if you win a 5,000 claiming race here, the world knows you won a race at Keeneland.
Yeah.
Because everybody watches that. They can't tell you where else you won a race at, but they can tell you if you won it at Keeneland.
You know, we started by talking about some of the numbers or the smaller numbers that you have, Neil, as opposed to the bigger name trainers. But you look back on some of the years and some of the good years that you've had. 1991 was probably your best year. You had 14 winners that year. 92, 10 winners. 93, you had 10 winners, including those pair of graded stakes races. 2011, more recently, was a good year for you. You had 13 winners that year, more than $440,000 in purse earnings. What was going on that year that made it so special?
I think I had a couple decent horses, you know, and I had probably like 15 horses instead of six or eight. I mean, there was one year I was down in New Orleans, I had one horse for the whole meet.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, the numbers fluctuate.
Is that difficult to keep going and keep coming to the barn every morning and working when you only have one horse?
It was then because he wasn't even a good horse. he was a 12-5 horse.
How do you do it? How do you keep getting up and keep coming to the barn every morning?
You just do it. You know, it's not something that you think that, oh, I have to get up and go out to work tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's just something you do. That's part of life. You got to get up. You got to go.
Do you ever think about going and doing something else?
For about 3 seconds, and then I realized I'm not qualified for anything else. I mean, I don't know if I could go wait on you at McDonald's or not.
You help out a lot of other trainers, and you'll go saddle horses for them if for some reason they can't be at the racetrack that day or if they have other things going on, whatever it might be. Chris Block is one that comes to mind. You're very close with trainer Chris Block. He's been on this program before. It was a while back, but tell me about that relationship with Chris.
I got to be good friends with Chris when I started going to Arlington, and Chris is just a really, really good guy, a great horseman, top trainer. He really didn't get his dues until he started getting Giant Oak and Never Retreat and the filly that won the Queen Elizabeth here, Bakar. Mm-hmm. But he's always been a great caretaker, a good horseman, and I respect him quite a bit. And because of that, we became good friends because I know how he treats the horses and what he does and just being a great guy on top of it. And his whole family is nice.
Yeah.
There's not a weak link in the family from his brothers and sisters, mom and dad. His nieces and nephews are all nice, well-behaved. And his son is great. And we've just become very, very close friends.
He would often say that he trusts Neil Pessin with his horses. And I know when you're in New Orleans and Chris might not be able to be there, you're the man overseeing everything for him. That's a pretty awesome responsibility.
Yeah, especially when he sends the good horses. You know, when he sends the cheaper horses, not really. But he'll call once every, you know, 3 months. How's that one doing? Great. Get a good one, he might call, you know, twice a day. Okay. Yeah, yeah, he's doing great.
That was quite a horse, wasn't he? Giant Oak?
He was. I think that's a horse that never really reached his full potential, even though he won two grade ones. He was a horse that would run, and he might finish third. And it might take two people to walk him cooling out. Wow. And it'd really make you mad to see a horse come back with that much energy right after the race.
Yep.
You'd like to see him, if they didn't win, just be a little tired. But he wasn't. He was always full energy. He was like the Ever-Ready Bunny.
Yeah.
And he was big, handsome, and a handful.
Yeah, he was a good-looking horse. I can remember going to see him when I was at Arlington, and just a gorgeous horse.
Yeah, he was. Had a lot of chrome on him.
Yep.
But a big chestnut and just a grand-looking horse. Hopefully he makes a good stallion.
Who are some of the other horses you've been around, other than the big names that we've talked about, some of the other horses that stand out to you that you're just never going to forget?
Oh, that's tough. Well, the one horse that I started and broke his maiden was a horse named Judge Angelusi.
Yeah. Tell me his story. You said that might be the best horse you've ever trained, right?
Yeah, he's one of them. He was owned by Tom Gentry, who, as you know, was very quiet and low-key. And we got him ready to run. I ran him at Turfway. And actually, him and Ali Sheba both broke their maiden at the same meet at Turfway.
Wow.
Judge Angelusi broke his going three quarters, and Ali Sheba broke his going a mile.
Okay.
And Tom came up in his big van and everything, and I guess afterwards the van caught on fire inside, and he had like $10,000 in cash in the van. And he sent a guy working for him. He said, go in, I'll give you $100 if you get my money out.
Well, that's generous.
Yeah, that was generous. So the guy risked his life going in for $100.
He did go in.
He went in, got the money, and came back out. It was a little smoky, you know, a little smoke inhalation. Never hurt anybody.
What made Judge Angelucci so good?
Just his ability. He had the right mind. We brought him here to Kingland, and he had a slight issue, but Tom didn't want to stop on him. So he stopped on him I made him stop on him, actually, and got him back ready to send out to Whittingham in California.
Mm-hmm.
But he ran him here once with him calling the shots, and he did no good. And then he had to go out of town, and he left me instructions on what to do and would call every day. And I told him, fine, yep, yep, yep. Well, I pulled the horse's shoes and was just walking him in the barn. So when he came back to run the horse, I got a little bit of an ass chewing. I said, well, you're going to ruin a good horse. So
when you're watching him run in those big races with Charlie after he leaves your care, especially a race like the Breeders' Cup, right? It was Ferdinand, Judge Angelucci, and Ali Sheba that were all battling through the stretch. Are you kind of like a proud papa watching him run?
Yeah, I am. I am. I was happy because I knew if I hadn't done what I did, he wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
So that was the main thing. But I also knew that Ferdinand was going to beat him. Only because of the way Whittingham, even though Judge had won the race before, the way Whittingham was using Judge Angelusi as a breeze mate for Ferdinand, let Ferdinand lay off of him and come on, I knew what he was doing. And I know Charlie thought that Ferdinand was the better horse, so he was using Judge as his rabbit to set him up in the works.
Is that aggravating for you to see that happen, knowing?
Not really, because I wasn't making any money off of it. So, I mean, if I'd been financially involved, yeah, it would have been.
Neil Pessin joining me on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Really enjoying our visit here tonight. Hope you are as well. Don't forget, you can stream us at horseracingradio.net. You can check out a podcast of this program and all of our weekly talk shows at horseracingradio.net. You're considered to be an ambassador for racing at Arlington. I've heard that, and I've actually read that on a couple of different occasions. Do you look at yourself in that manner?
I don't look at myself like that, but I'm very outgoing, and especially with new people or people that have never even been in the horse business. You know, Arlington, the fairgrounds would do tours occasionally. You know, people touring the backside, and I would always open my barn up to people to come in, and we would explain to them what all the equipment was. They'd come get to feed the horses mints and pet the horses, and, you know, especially for the kids, they used to have a lot of, you know, 7, 8, 9-year-olds, you know, classes come. So, and I still do that today with people. You know, friends will call, can I bring so-and-so out? I said, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, the more people we can get interested in the game, the better shot we got of having a game later on down the road.
Yeah, and I love your approach, because I think that once people get to experience it, the intimidation factor goes away, because this is a very intimidating sport for new people when they first walk in and they're seeing horses coming from everywhere, and then people are being roped off so the horses can come through, and then there's a tote board with all kinds of numbers up there, and nobody knows what to make of them when they first start out. And if you can take that intimidation factor away, like you're doing at the barn area, and teach them about that side of it, I think that goes a long way in terms of creating a new fan base.
Oh, I do too. And you know, you got to get them interested in the horse first.
Yep.
That's the main thing. So if they can get an attachment to the horse, you know, say I have 1,000 people go through the barn and we get one owner. That's one more than we've got. And it might be someone who's a major owner down the road.
Yeah.
You know, it's worth doing. And if nothing else, just for people say, man, I went to Kingland, had a great time. Or I went to the fairgrounds or Arlington and I had a great time and we got to go to the barn. And, you know, word of mouth spreads better than anything. But you can go to some cities and you can go 5 minutes from the racetrack and you'll ask somebody, hey, how do you get to Arlington Park? What is it? They don't know.
Right.
They couldn't tell you, darn sure couldn't tell you where it is. but don't even know what it is.
Yeah.
And there's still people out there that feel that you have to know someone to get in, that the races are all fixed, which they're not. We wish they were so we could make money when we bet.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, I mean, then everyone would be making cash, you know. But
well, you kind of have a shtick as well, and I'll call it a shtick, when people come by the barn. You kind of make it very light, and you'll introduce them to the horse, and you'll kind of joke around with the horses a little bit. And you're always great for a laugh with all the people when they come by. And that has to go a long way toward helping them feel comfortable being back there.
Well, and that's one reason I do it, too, because you want people to be comfortable and at ease when they're back there. So, you know, you may even spook them a little bit. You know, you take a kid's hand, and or usually I get the mother and give her the mint. And she's going up, and I'll go, watch out. And she'll jump back real fast.
That's just mean.
Right. And it is. But the kids laugh. Everybody else laughs. And then I go, only kidding. He's okay.
Mom's never coming back to the racetrack again.
Oh, no. But she loves it, too, when it's all over with. Because then the horse will take the mint out of her hand, and she's just happy as a lark.
If Neil Pessin is commissioner of racing, if we had one, what are the first things you're going to do to try to increase that fan base?
Well, the first thing I think you got to do is, one, fix a few things with the sport. You got to, you know, right now, if just say someone wants to go to the Derby, he's got no shot of getting a seat anywhere. Zero. So we got to make that a little easier. I don't know if it's increasing the seating capacity or if it's opening the seats up to, I know they're all big into the corporate, but you got to open the fan base up where other people can get seats. You know, if I want to go to the Indy 500, I can call up and get a seat somewhere. If I want to go to the Derby, forget it. Same with a lot of the major horse racing.
Unless you pay a lot of money.
Right, but who wants to pay, you know.
But you could say the same thing about the Super Bowl, right?
You're still not going to pay $1,500 for a seat.
Not face value.
No.
Right.
No, but I mean, you're not even going to scalp one for $1,500. Right. You go to the Super Bowl, if you go at game time and you get there and you got $500 in your pocket, you're getting in.
You'll get in.
I don't care who's playing, you're getting in. You go to the UK basketball game for the Final Four, the final game, if you got $500 in your pocket, you're getting in.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what venue it is. You try going to the Derby and it's tough to get in.
Yeah.
Especially a seat where you can see anything.
Sure.
So, and I think we need to make it easier for the fans to participate. You know, like right now, say we had 37,000 out here this past Saturday. How many of them had a seat?
Yeah, very few.
How many?
Not 37,000.
No, but I mean, how many of them had to stand? Who wants to come stand for 5 hours on blacktop?
Right.
Even though you get to move around, go see the horses, but it's tough moving around. You know, we've got to make that easier for the fans. The other thing you got to make easier is betting. And the one thing that drives me nuts on the HRTV and the TVG is they'll show a post parade at Santa Anita instead of showing a live race someplace else. There's only a few things a bettor wants to know. Did I win and how much did I win? That's the two things he wants to know.
Sure.
That's the main two. And if he knows how much, then he knows how much he can bet the next race. So, and sometimes the prices will take forever to come up. You know, so we need to make that bettor.
How about using technology? Does racing do a good enough job of implementing technology and what we see on cell phones and tablets and those types of things now? Do we do enough?
No, it needs to be bettor. And I'm not a techno guy.
Yeah.
Believe me, I fight it with a passion for my personal self. But for the horse racing, it needs to be bettor. I mean, even if you go on a website, say you use your phone right now to watch a race live, which is nice to do on ones that'll let you do it because everyone's blocking everybody else from watching the signal, which drives me nuts. When my dad built Kentucky Downs.
Yeah.
And when we built that, we sent our signal up in the clear. We were one of the first ones to do that. And everyone said we were nuts. Dad said, what's the worst thing going to happen? Someone's going to turn on the channel and watch the races from Kentucky Downs. Wouldn't that be awful?
Right.
So we need to make it where they can bet a little bettor, get the results a little quicker. And you turn on, you watch a race live now, and they break out of the gate and they run an eighth of a mile and it freezes. And it stays frozen until after the race is over. There's got to be something we can do about that.
Yep.
And And I still think we need to do a better job. I mean, I don't know how many times you watch simulcasting, but how many times at major racetracks, say there's only like two or three major racetracks running at the same time, that you'll see the races running at identically the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm big on that as well. I think coordinating post times and having all tracks stick to the scheduled post times and not go a little bit late so they run on top of another track, I agree with you 100% there.
This is the only major sport that doesn't have a commissioner. All the other major sports have it. And that's why we've gone, I think, from one or two back in the 30s sport in the country to bowling and fence painting are ahead of us now.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this question, Neil, because obviously as a trainer, you're traveling all over the country and you're running horses in different states, which means you're playing by different rules in every state from a medication standpoint to an equipment standpoint, whatever it might be. That's the biggest problem, isn't it? That every state has different regulations and rules, and that's what makes it so difficult to have a commissioner?
Well, no, we can still have a commissioner. I mean, they could have said that, you know, they said, well, you got this ego owns this track and this ego. Well, go to baseball and basketball and football and see those major egos that own those teams. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people should have nothing to do with it. We should have a commissioner. But it should be, the problem is no one will agree on who the commissioner could be and no one can agree on medication. So on what rules should be. You know, should medication be allowed? Absolutely. Should Lasix be allowed? Absolutely. I mean, there's going to be people out there telling you no, but a lot of those people are using other stuff that can't be detected. So if you do away with medication for the little guy, you're putting the guy that's cheating that much farther ahead of him. You're making it tougher on the little guy by having no medication. Mm. And I'm not saying give the horse the kitchen sink, but allow like Lasix and
therapeutic.
Therapeutic. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like any athlete.
And I know there's some owners out there and some people going, oh, we can't be saying that.
But, well, it's like other athletes in other sports. That's the argument, you know, for medication and racing is the fact that athletes will use an inhaler if they have asthma, for example, because it'll make their breathing easier, or they'll take Advil or some other over-the-counter type of medication to reduce swelling, things like that. And that's where I know the horsemen have come in and said, hey, this is why we need this, because there are therapeutic medications that are not performance enhancers that will help the horse.
Right. And if you really want to look, the people that are hollering about everything so much, you know, let's go back to the breeding. We've inbred so much that the horses, you know, everyone wants to blame the trainers for the horses not staying sound. Well, all the inbreeding they've done has made the bone density a lot less. A horse's cannon bone used to be probably 50% bigger than it is now. That's why they used to be able to run so much back then. That's one. Two, they change the conformation of the foals at a young age. They do the PE stripping and nuts and bolts to change the way a horse's conformation is. Well, as anyone can tell you that watch me walk, I toe out pretty good.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. So, but if I were to stand straight for a minute, actually less than about 30 seconds, my knees go to hurting. Just from standing, not walking, just standing straight. My knees start hurting and my legs start to hurt. Now we're changing the conformation of the foals, you know, from a young age. And I think that's something that needs to actually be stopped, because we used to breed, one of the three things we bred for was conformation. Well, if we change what they look like, how do we know what their conformation is? And is that fair to the guy buying a filly at the sale that's looking for something to race and breed? He's got one that looks correct, but then the foals are going to come out crooked.
Yeah, we could spend another hour talking about this, and
May
do that up the road sometime, Neil. But I always like to end our trainer talk shows by asking trainers what other interests or hobbies they have that people might not know about.
Horse racing.
That's it. No other sports? UK?
Well, UK basketball and football. I'm a UK fan.
Yeah.
Good or bad. Even football, I'm a UK fan, diehard.
Was it hard for you to get over the Final Four loss this year?
It was only for, I'm not sure that they got beat or the refs beat them. And I know that sounds like a crying thing, but, you know, the 2 points they gave him on the shot clock violation and then the foul they called on Harrison where he never even contacted him, those were turnaround points in the game. Whether they'd have still lost or not, I don't know.
Neil Pessin here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Neil, like all of our guests who appear on the program, you'll receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors. It's Flair Equine Nasal Strips, so we'll get those to you and really appreciate all the time. And
cash is always good, too.
Cash works?
Cash works.
We'll see if we can arrange that, too. We appreciate it, my friend.
Thanks
so much. Neil Pessin here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. If you missed any portion of the show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast there. Of course, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. And back every Wednesday, 6 to 7 Eastern, right here with Trainer Talk. For my producer, Lee Delapina, for Neil Pessin, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening.